Hi, this is Barry Livingston. I'm an actor. You might know me best as Ernie from My Three Sons and many other projects like The Social Network and films, other films like Argo. And I'm talking to Mr. Media, and I have no idea who the hell this guy is.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to comic scholar and Randolph-Macon College professor M. Thomas Inge. His latest book, Will Eisner, Conversations. Stick around and do whatever you can to keep Frank Miller away from this Will Eisner project. This is Bob Andelman, and this is the Mr. Media Interview, brought to you today by the Stitcher app for mobile devices. Give it a test drive today at stitcher.com/mrmedia, Mr. Media. I love this free radio app, and I think you will too. Stitcher.com/mrmedia. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of not exactly comic scholars who will comb through every line of this interview in search of mistakes, double meanings, and buried Easter eggs in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. Tom Inge has made a cottage industry of collecting the best interviews done with a variety of pop culture figures of the 20th century and bringing them out in book form. All told, he's responsible for a remarkable 40 books, putting together volumes featuring as diverse a crowd as Peanuts comic strip creator Charles Schulz and American literary lion William Faulkner. His latest collection is familiar ground for me, Will Eisner, Conversations. It's a book that covers the depth and breadth of the late American master of comics' entire eight-decade career and is a great companion piece, if I don't mind saying so myself, to my own 2005 authorized biography, Will Eisner, A Spirited Life. In fact, I first read many of the interviews in Inge's book either at Eisner's suggestion or discovered them in the file cabinet of his Florida studios. Now, if you consider yourself any kind of student of comics history, this new book is one you'll definitely want on your shelf, in a sealed Mylar bag, of course. Inge, by the way, is the Robert Emery Blackwell Professor of the Humanities at Randolph-Macon College in Mississippi. Now let that be a lesson to you fanboys still living in your mother's basements. You can get a real job in the real world and still love comics. Tom Inge, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thank you, and let me go back and correct one minor thing. I'm not located in Mississippi.
Oh.
The University Press of Mississippi publishes the books, but my college is located in Ashland, Virginia, not too far from Richmond or not too far from Washington, D.C. So except for that slight geographical dislocation, everything else is fine.
Well, I think I promised the fanboys some mistakes that they could get to. I just didn't think it'd be that easy for them.
That's okay. People say a lot to University of Mississippi Press, and there's no such press as that. It's the University Press of Mississippi. But anyway, when it comes to Mississippi, people often have problems. It's not has not been one of the most popular states in the Union, but they are a powerful source of really good books on the comics, I think. And I was working with them with Faulkner before, and I helped them get into popular culture, then into the comics. And I think they're one of the more successful university presses these days, not for what they publish in literature and history, but for their comics publications, and they're known for that now. So we've helped contribute to the survival of a scholarly press by what some people consider a mediocre a form of art, which you and I know, however, is not the case. This is art with a capital A, no matter how you look at it.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's great that that there are, you know, university presses that are willing to tackle comics.
And after Mississippi, what happens? Yale University Press gets in there. Johns Hopkins is in there. Just about all the major, University of California, they were doing some things with David Koons early on. But now all the university presses have their unit on the comics, primarily because Mississippi proved that it could be done and that it could be profitable.
I think that's wonderful. And, you know, I wanted to ask you, your books, to me at least, they seem to suggest a certain single-mindedness of purpose on your part. And I wondered, when did you find that these collections were sort of your sweet spot?
What was the question exactly? When did
When did you realize that these collections were?
Oh, putting together the books like this. Well, I'm imitating a successful series that went before this, also out of University Press of Mississippi. They started conversations with writers. And they started picking up all the major American writers and doing collections of interviews, because getting them all together in one place makes them very convenient for research. If a student or scholar or general reader wants to know about that person, everything is brought here together. And that proved very successful. I did a book for that series on Truman Capote, and then I did one on William Faulkner. But then they started a conversation with film directors series based on that one. And then I said, well, hey, you know, there's another group of people here we need to cover, the comic artists. And they were very amenable to the idea. And there was a director of the press named Seetha Srinivasan. She's, as you can tell by her name, Indian by background, but very acute in terms of her understanding of American popular culture. And so she helped me convince them that this was a good thing to do. Now, I understand, or I have heard, that there was a little resistance in the press over the whole idea of doing comics materials in general. But a few years later, the same people came to her and told her, boy, we're glad you made a move in that direction, because that has been very profitable for the press. I borrowed the idea from somewhere else and then tried to get good people together to collect the interviews. And it's a continuing series. We're still looking, in fact, for contributors to assemble these materials, but it's not easy work. I mean, you know yourself from having written a biography how difficult it is to gather everything in print. You feel like you need to read it all if you can. And so it takes a lot of work. And for cartoonists and comic artists, you have to go to unusual places, publications that no one's ever heard of before. You know, I had to go to Dave Sim and one of his little publications to get a very good interview that Sim did that's in there. And in fact, there were several interviews I wanted to use in the book, but I could never locate a single person who had anything to do with the publication, much less who owned the copyright. And so, and of course, you can't reprint an essay or an interview unless you have the permission of the copyright holder. And I never could find out who they were, and it disappeared off the face of the earth, as best I can tell. But, you know, fandom, and these are fan publications in most cases.
Did you look in any of their mother's basements?
Who?
Did you look for them in their mother's basements? Because I think that's where they probably all are.
My mother's?
No. The people who wrote these interviews, did you, when you were looking for them, maybe they were in their mother's basements.
Well, or they'd gone on to greater things. I don't know which. But, you know, fandom, too, I'm sure. But it's a hit. There's some people who get very enthusiastic, and they'll do this one thing. They'll write this one article. They'll publish this two issues of a magazine, and they lose all interest, and they go off and do something else. And so, you know, it's the nature of the beast, I suppose. But in any case, I think I found most of the really good ones. And like you, I went through Will's files and made copies of everything there. And had it not been for his...
I'm sorry, we lost the last thing you said. You said that you went through his files, and if not for his...
If it were not for those files, mm-hmm. There were several interviews I would never have known about. That is to say, the only existing copy is in his files.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. We both tapped the same files, I think, and there was just some amazing stuff there. I remember being a teenager in the 70s and being involved with comics fandom at the time, and I remember, I mean, it was great training ground for what I do now, in that I was constantly interviewing people and reading the fanzines and starting fanzines and stopping fanzines. And the thing was, there was all that great material that no one will ever find. It wasn't ever copyrighted. It's not registered in a common place. You know, it may be that somebody died with all the existing copies.
Well, that allows me to put in a plug for a pet project of mine, and that is I've been collecting these kinds of materials, fan magazines. In fact, it was a period of time when I was constantly writing to people who were publishing them, either buying copies, in many cases they contributed them, and they're all at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond. They have built a major comic art collection there now, starting with this kind of material that I gave them, and I have, therefore, I think on file, probably the most extensive set of fan-type publications anywhere around, unless there's somebody else out there, and there could be, who has been collecting materials in the same way. And that is the most difficult material to find. That is the material I decide I would try to collect, try to hold on, try to preserve, for the very reasons you're suggesting. And I'm sure there are many cases where I may have the only copy in existence there. So that's the kind of work that I've seen myself doing, however, in all my work. We also have a series of great comic artists, it's called, and these are biographical critical studies of important cartoonists. But I've seen all my work has been directed towards assembling, collecting, making available, and keeping the record of this material, because that's where the future doctoral dissertations are going to be written, to the horror of some of my colleagues. That's where the really fun material is to be found. And an interesting thing, when I asked Will about publishing this book, about doing a book like this, the first thing he said was, okay, but I'll have to go back and revise the essays.
Typical.
And I tried to say, Will, no, it's not about, it's about history. It's about preserving the record, and your revisions are not a part of the record. Now, I proceeded, you know, without checking back with him, and unfortunately, he died before I finished the project. But in any case, his impulse, and this was always true of all of his work, was to rewrite history, to go back and redraw the perfect spirit story, if he could.
He, you know, it's only recently, the book I did came out 7 years ago now. It was actually done 8 years ago.
And, time flies.
Yeah, I mean, and the thing that I discovered kind of after the fact was that only maybe one or two things that he told me in the couple of years that I interviewed him for the book were kind of revisionist history. You know, Ken Quattro recently published that information about the
Superman.
Yeah, and yeah. That was the stories that Will told, unfortunately, were completely off.
I know,
off the historical track, and made me wonder about.
Well, yeah, you know, we're all human, and I think we all tend to revise our past. I mean, I find myself doing it at my age, especially now. Or it's not really so much an intention to revise as much as you really remember it that way. That is to say, you've told yourself over and over so many times what happened, and you begin to believe the story you fabricated. He's a storyteller, after all, you know, fiction writer. And I can imagine how he wanted to expunge that from his memory, you know, so to speak, and therefore get rid of it altogether. Of course, you can say he didn't have to go ahead and embellish it the way he did
yeah.
to make himself look good, which is, again, is something we all do. We want to make ourselves look good in terms of what happens. And I'm sure we all have little regretful moments in our lives, and I expect that was one. Also, he never let people know he didn't finish high school, which you know, doesn't bother me one whit. Who cares? I mean, and it can be said about the testimony. Who cares? I mean, my God, he gave us such great work, great art, great literature, that I can forgive him anything. And I think as you well found out, he was a man of great soul and spirit. And I have nothing but respect for him. And if that's the only lapse he was guilty of, then I have no problems. He could have a few more if he wanted to. It would still be okay with me.
Oh, he might have one or two that we still haven't discovered. He's entitled. Tom, what do we learn about an individual like a Faulkner or a Schultz, an Eisner, from reading a Q&A interview that we don't get in a narrative book? Mm-hmm. I mean, I have my own suspicions, but I'm curious, since you've done so much of this, what you think.
Well, I think for one thing, you get closer to the truth. When somebody sits down to write, you talk about manufacturing, you know, a past for yourself. Perhaps you saw the little book I did of Schultz's essays, beautifully written essays. But he sat down and paid attention, and therefore he had a chance to make sense out of things in a way that he would not have ordinarily. When you have to respond to a spontaneous question, the first thing you're going to have to dip into is what happened. And now if you're on your toes, you can on the spot revise it a little bit. But basically speaking, you're probably going to say what's on top of your head, and on what's on top of your head is probably close to the truth, as I think, you know, our presidential nominee Romney demonstrated in that unfortunate comment about 47%. I think that's what the man really thinks. And he let it go, and he should not have, and he's spending all of his time trying to recover from that. So I think that the spontaneous interview gets closer to the truth. Also, when you the Gary Groth interview in the Schultz book, for example, Groth, he went in those interviews tooth and nail for several days at a time. And so it's a very long interview for that reason. And he was able to revisit with Schultz things he had said before and reevaluate them. And therefore, I think he was able in that interview to get a lot of really good information we might not have ordinarily. And I think that's the important thing. The presence of an interviewer, a journalist, or someone, you know, like myself, can probe at things in a way you cannot at a distance, sitting with all the interviews and all the material you've read and beginning to write and try to make up your mind about who this person was, what they were actually like. And what you're going to shape is probably your version of Will Eisner. And he may not be exactly my version, someone else's, but he's your version. But the interviews, I think, by and large, are the real version, closer to the real version. You know, we are so duplicitous and so full of dishonesty in our lives, original sin responsible for it or whatever, I'm not sure. That's hard for us to tell the truth, but we have to aim for it. And if we don't aim for the truth, then what is it all about? I'm sure my students think I'm trying to get them to think a certain way about things, but I'm never never trying to do that. I'm trying to get them to think for themselves, and that's the importance of education as far as I'm concerned. So I think the interviews provide that kind of important context. And the ability to follow up answers. You know, when they say one thing, to keep down that track or to challenge a statement. I mean, if you had known what you know now, you know, I don't know what Will would have said, but had this come out while he was alive, but you would have had a chance to give him the opportunity to explain his side. And that's what we don't have. We don't have his opportunity to explain, and there may be some factors that we don't know about.
I think there's two things that struck me as you were saying that. The one thing I get from the interviews, whether the interviews in Will Eisner Conversations or just in general, is that when they're done... when they're done, let's say honestly, you actually can hear that person's voice very well. You can hear them tell you, you know, you can sense the annoyance if they don't like the question, or you can also sense the thrill they're getting from someone, you know, kissing their butt sometimes. Now, the interesting thing, or the only thing that concerns me about interviews done in fanzines over the years, and I imagine it probably hasn't changed a lot today, is that because the people doing the interviews tend to be, with the exception perhaps of Gary Groth and the Comics Journal over the years, a lot of these guys who've done the interviews with people like Eisner and Kirby and Stan Lee, they've been such fanboys that they've always promised to let the person read the interview before it's published, yeah. And then it gets edited and changed, and the words, you know, and they start protecting themselves. And I always found that unfortunate. And I, you know, personally, I've resisted that for a lifetime, but I know it goes on.
Yeah. Oh, I know. And Will would nearly always ask that.
Absolutely.
Wanted to see it, you know. And I can understand that point of view, too. For me, if I had asked to see check on it, and I get interviewed, too, and I will often ask, can I see it, but I don't often get it back. I'm more concerned that I said it correctly, because of being a writer, being a professor of English, I'm more concerned with the way things are said, with the composition. So I want to be sure it reads well, being an English professor. But nevertheless, it's not a good thing. And I think, yeah, in truth, journalists should not show it. On the other hand, I have seen pieces that if the person who was interviewed had seen it, they would probably not have approved it, because the whole tenor of the interview is, and the way it's treated in the article is negative, for example. They're attacking you or something like that. So I can kind of see a desire to reshape it. But I guess, you know, if you're sensitive to this, probably the best thing to do is not give interviews. J.D. Salinger, not give interviews. I don't know what his problem was, but he would not get. Bill Watterson won't give interviews. You know, and yet you have to say, hey, Salinger in particular, and Watterson too, for that matter, you guys earn a lot of money, tons of money. You're wealthy now, comfortable in your little bunkers because we love your work. You know, don't you owe us a little something back, you know, just a little bit of light, a little bit of attention from you. And boy, they wouldn't do it.
You know, I happen to have here, I'm glad you brought it up. I've been working on my own book, Collected Interviews. And right here, you have this is the collected interviews of Bill Watterson and J.D. Salinger.
Ah, no kidding. In one book?
In one piece of paper.
No, on one piece of paper.
It's blank.
Oh, this is what I say.
Sorry. Okay. Sorry. Sorry to get off topic, folks. So
there are some, incidentally, though.
No, I know. There's a couple.
Yeah. I mean, even some Salinger. He gave some high school girl an interview one time and things like that. And Watterson gave a few. And there's one in Comics Journal of Watterson, as a matter of fact.
Well, so what can the Eisner fan who thinks they know everything about Will still learn from reading the interviews in Will Eisner Conversations?
Well, if they do what we were just saying they do, you get a chance to sit down and talk with a master. Or maybe it's more accurate to say we overhear a conversation mm-hmm. with a master. Because of what you were suggesting, the intonation and the kinds of emotions that can go into what they're saying, the extent to which they prevaricate or tell the truth, you come to know this person as a human being. Will Eisner, for me, and my first encounter was, of course, and I'm a lot older than you are, Bob, but on Sundays in Richmond when I was a kid, we would go to a newsstand, except it wasn't a newsstand, it was just a bunch of newspapers on the street. Some guy would bring in papers from all over the country on a Sunday morning, and I would buy the Baltimore Sun, because that was where the Spirit appeared. That's the only thing I cared about. Now, they had some other great comics, too, and I would read those, but I had to buy this big, fat newspaper just to get the Spirit. And so it was reading those stories which entranced me, but also at that time I wanted to be a cartoonist as well, and I was trying mightily drawing cartoons for my high school newspaper, and I would later for college and so on. And the more I looked at the style of his art, and the more I looked at the work of Milton Caniff and Walt Kelly and people like that, I said, hey, who am I trying to fool? I'm never going to be a great cartoonist. And so I finally ended up becoming a professor instead, of course, as you can tell. But one of the reasons for my continuing interest has to do with that child in me that loved comic art in the newspapers and wanting to do it. So for me, it was a signature, you know. There were no interviews, no fan magazines, things like that. There's no way I had to really find out who the person was. Frequently, I would write to the cartoonist, though, and I did. I wrote to Schultz. And in fact, I have an original sketch he did for me. And I wrote to Walt Kelly. I have original Pogo he did for me and so on. For some reason, Eisner seemed not as accessible as a regular newspaper comic artist, because that was not really like a newspaper comic strip. It was a comic book, and somehow the mystery of that appearing in a newspaper from somewhere. Anyway, I never tried to probe beyond it, and wasn't until much later in my adult life that I got in touch with him. And now I've forgotten what this was leading to. Oh, you were saying, what can you gain from reading the book that you wouldn't have ordinarily? As I was trying to say and got off on another track, the personality, the person. Now, as for details of his life, I haven't really done a point-by-point comparison with your book or the Schumann biography that came out, too. I don't know whether things in there that are not discussed there or not, but there could be. I mean, you know, you guys can't cover everything, after all. And you can't include all the details. There may be some facts about his life, events in his life. I've often felt that when you read these interviews, you know, cover to cover, it's in a sense like reading a biography. And Will had a tendency to kind of go back to starting every time, which can get boring for some readers. But in editing the series, I decided we would not take out repetitions, because the repetitions themselves are part of the historic record and are indicative of what's at the top of the mind of an interviewer who approaches him. They nearly always ask about the spirit right away. Well, that says something about the spirit. Therefore, for the sake of the historic record, we keep the repetitions in. Some of the fans in particular don't like them, because they like to sit down and read it through like one of the books from Tomorrow's, you know, with lots of pictures and things like that, and they put it aside and that's it. And if you start repeating things, they get irritated. they want a new story every page.
Plus, they need their pictures. They're comics fans.
Yeah, I know, that's right. But it seems to me you do get a sense, particularly from Will's. You know, I thought you get a sense of his life and his view of it as time went by, with what he had accomplished, as he continued to look. He was always looking back, because everything always went back to the spirit, no matter where he was at present. So in any case, you get a sense of the life. The Schultz is less so, because his interviews didn't always have to do that history. His interviews were one history, peanuts, that's all of it. But Will's was many different things, many different endeavors, many different aspects in his life. And I think, you know, that's something that you would certainly get that you would find difficult to find otherwise.
Well, I mean, Schultz, he was basically, this is not to take anything away from him, he was a great talent, but he was a one-act career. Eisner was a four-act, a five-act. I mean, there were so many different, yeah.
He reinvented himself. You know, he was a businessman, he was a president of a syndicate at one point. He was running that the company that produced the PS magazine, and there was a lot of Will that was business oriented. Mm-hmm. One thing that was true of him was that he really looked out for himself and knew how to do that in a very cutthroat and a very nasty business. I mean, the fact that he held on to the spirit is a remarkable act. You know, I don't know what to say, a good sense or an act of courage in a way, because that's not the way it was done. But my God, wasn't that a bright thing to do, and the right thing to do, certainly for him. And he had income coming in from that work all of his life. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether he could have had the means to do his graphic novels and things later on, although he apparently earned a lot of money from the business interests too. So he was savvy just to any way you look at it. Whereas you look at some of these other people, I mean, Jack Kirby, and as great as some of these artists are, they didn't know how to protect themselves. They were not business-oriented. They wanted to draw.
Right.
Crazy thing about people who want to draw is they are happy to do it for you whether they get paid or not.
Well, you know, I'm sure you know this. Most people probably don't, but one of Will's most successful publishing projects was when he did the illustrations for a book of alcoholic drinks. And he drew pictures of what glass they were supposed to be in and what they should look like, and that is still in print. And he's made a fortune off of that over the years.
On the other hand, he did QPs and baseball comics.
Yeah,
and that was a disaster.
Not exactly. Big money makers there. And you know, you may find this interesting. Later this year, bringing out an electronic digital version of A Spirited Life, and. Right. That will have a series of interviews, Q&As that I did with people about Will that either fill in gaps that were missed in the biography or talk about things that happened since then, like the book or, I mean, the spirit movie, things like that. So, I'm a big fan of the Q&A format, so that's why I find this very interesting stuff. So,
a lot of things in that memorial service, too.
Right.
I don't know whether that transcript exists or not. But, you know, everybody who was anybody got there and said a few words about him.
Yeah, that was quite a day. It would be nice to be able to see that if it was – probably wasn't videotaped, but somebody recorded
some,
it.
Website was transcribing them for a while, but then I think they never finished the project. I don't know.
You know, I do remember that because I remember because my eulogy turned up online somewhere. That's weird. I'll have to look into that. So, all right. So, we could go on for a long time, but let me ask you this: whose interviews would you, as a reader, like to see collected in the future?
I didn't quite get that question because it stalled and stopped.
Who's? I mean, who would you like to read a collection of interviews from in the future yourself?
Wait a minute. Oh, who would I like to read a collection of interviews?
Yeah, I mean, would you like to read a collection of, Alfred Hitchcock interviews or Stan Lee interviews? I'm just picking names out of thin air.
Yeah, well, we've done the Stan Lee series. I've already read.
Okay.
That one. There is a Alfred Hitchcock in the other film director series. I don't know. The problem with me is, and I'm sure this has to be true for you, I'm so busy writing and producing, I don't have time to sit and read books, you know. And I try to review books now and then just to make myself, pay attention. And there's so much coming out now on comics that I don't think one person can keep up with it anyway. I don't know that. I think just about everybody I would want to hear interviewed, and I did the Faulkner one. He is somebody that I did meet once and did publish an interview with him. But writers are the people that I find of most interest, I guess. And my favorite writer in the world right now is somebody who suddenly became renowned in the past few days, Mo Yan, the Chinese Nobel Prize novelist. He was Nobel Prize material, and by God, he got the Nobel Prize. The problem is, when I'm with him, he doesn't speak English, and I don't speak Mandarin, so we can't talk too much except with an interpreter. But I would like to see a group of good interviews with him, as a matter of fact. But I don't think I don't think I'm gonna be able to do that myself. Maybe somebody else will. But I guess I don't really sit down much and read a collection all the way through, cover to cover anyway. I dip into it, and if I'm writing, for example, on a novel by Faulkner, an essay of some kind, I'll go back and check through the interview volume and see what he said about the novel, because sometimes you find useful illustrations. So I guess this is true of books in general. I don't have time to sit down and read a book cover to cover. I did just finish reading Umberto Eco's latest book called This Is Not the End of the Book. It's the name of the book. And it's all about the book disappearing. But I read that cover to cover because it was, in fact, a collection of interviews. He didn't write the book, but somebody did a series of interviews with him and a French film director. But it's all about very pertinent things. But the irony of being a professor of literature is I got into it because I love literature, but now I don't have time to read literature. And I consider comics one of our most important forms of literature.
There you go. Last question. What's next? What do you have coming up?
Yeah, I'm working right now on a Faulkner. See, I sort of move back and forth between my love of the comics and my love of literature. And what I've done in this case, and this is a slight turn on the idea of anthologies, what I've done is to track down essays by other writers in the United States and throughout the world who have testified to the power of Faulkner's influence on their work. What I'm trying to pinpoint is, what did they learn from Faulkner? And so I've assembled a couple of hundred pieces. Probably I won't be able to get them all into the book, and also have permission problems and things like that. But when the book is done, one ought to be able to sit down and read and see what these writers thought and why they liked Faulkner so much. You couldn't do a book like that for someone like Hemingway or John Dos Passos or Steinbeck, because those writers didn't elicit that response from other writers the way Faulkner did. Many writers felt like Faulkner taught them how to write. And that's Hemingway. If you write like Hemingway, you sound like Hemingway. But Faulkner, he wrote different ways. Every single novel is different from every other novel. And I don't mean to hijack an Eisner interview in direction of Faulkner, mind you. But that's what I'm working on, you ask.
No, I was interested very much.
And after that, there's going to be a collection of essays on Crazy Cat and George Herman, which I'm going to collect. These will be new essays and old essays.
Very good. Very good. Well, listen, folks. You can find Tom Inge's latest collection of creative interviews, Will Eisner, Conversations, in great bookstores everywhere, or you can order it right now at a great price at MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. Tom, can people find you online? Is there a website? Are you on Facebook? Any of that kind of fun stuff?
Not really, but I have an email address.
Oh, let's not give that out.
Okay.
That might be a little too much.
Go to Randolph-Macon College, and you could track me down if you needed to.
Very good. Well, Tom Inge, thank you so much for joining us on Mr. Media today.
My pleasure, Bob. I don't do Skype every day, so I want you to know this is a tribute to you and Will Eisner.
Well, I'll only speak for myself. I'm sure Will appreciates wherever he is, but thank you very much.
Okay.
You can see and hear almost 1,000 Mr. Media interviews by visiting our main site, MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com, or check out the more than 200 video interviews on the Mr. Media Radio site on YouTube. And I'd sure appreciate if you'd show some love for Mr. Media's advertisers, including Stitcher. Apple named Stitcher a top 5 news app of 2011. It's a free mobile app for your smartphone or tablet that lets you listen to your favorite shows and discover the best of news, entertainment, and sports on demand. You can listen whenever you want to more than 5,000 shows, get customized recommendations, and discover what your friends are listening to. My own list of Stitcher favorites is pretty eclectic. I start my day with an hour of MSNBC's Morning Joe with Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski. Then it's the latest two-minute update from the Onion News Network. After that, I'll listen to WTF with Mark Maron, Here's the Thing with Alec Baldwin, HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher, and excerpts from E's Chelsea Lately and The Soup with Joel McHale. Also in regular rotation on my Stitcher playlist, The BS Report with ESPN's Bill Simmons, The TechCrunch Headlines, and The Don Geronimo Show. The latest episodes of each show, whether originating from broadcasts, cable TV, radio syndication, or podcasts, are continuously updated. Stitcher is a free app for your iPhone, iPad, Kindle, Fire, BlackBerry, Droid, and more. And show your support of Mr. Media by getting, did I mention it's free? The app at stitcher.com/Mr. Media. That's stitcher.com/MR Media. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. We're also supported by Audible. Check out Audible's 30-day trial membership and download the audiobook version of the book everyone's been talking about, 50 Shades of Grey by E.L. James. Sign up for your free trial today at audible.com/radio. Again, audibletrial.com/radio. And finally, if you need a disc jockey for a wedding, bar mitzvah, event, or please consider calling 1-800-DIAL-DJS, the party authority, for all your party entertainment needs. You can call 1-800-DIAL-DJS or go to their website, 1-800-DIAL-DJS.com, and tell them Mr. Media sent you. And thanks for listening.